History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. The popular idea of the Civil War is that Abraham Lincoln single-handedly led the Union to victory. But it wasn't just him that did it. There were many members of the House and Senate that not only made some of the most important factors of the Civil War and Reconstruction possible, like emancipation, but were actually the people that introduced it to Lincoln and came up with it. Today I'm speaking to Fergus Bordwich, who's the author of the new book, Congress at War: How Republican Reformers Fought the Civil War, Defied Lincoln, Ended Slavery, and Remade America. We're going to look at four members of Congress, including Thaddeus Stevens, Pitt Fessenden, Ben Wade, and the pro-slavery Clement Vandingham. And we look at how a newly empowered Republican Party shaped one of the most dynamic and consequential periods of American history. From reinventing the nation's financial system to pushing President Lincoln to emancipate the slaves to the planning for Reconstruction, Congress undertook huge measures to defeat the Confederacy, in the process laying the foundation for a strong central government that came fully into being in the 20th century. And also, the people in this period were absolutely larger than life. In antebellum America, there were no national sports, there weren't hobbies in the way we have them today. Politics was sort of the gladiatorial combat sport of the period, so the Senate in Washington, D.C. was one of the most popular tourist attractions of the city, and oratory was probably at its highest point as an art at any time in American history as it ever would be and ever has been, where congressmen could give speeches for 3 hours or 4 hours, and if you look at them, they look like great works of literature, but the way they would speak, it looked like Inherent the Wind, or somebody on a stage in a Hollywood film in the golden era. It's really interesting personalities, but the congressmen in this time period shaped America during the Civil War and afterwards and laid the groundwork for much of what comes in the 20th century. So there's a lot to unpack here about people you may not have heard about, but have a very important role in American history, and I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Fergus Bordwich. Fergus, welcome to the show.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Well, a lot of what your book does is try to reframe the dominant narrative about the period of Civil War and the immediate aftermath in terms of Reconstruction and the gigantic shadow that is cast by Lincoln and his legacy. Before we get into the details and argument of your book, can you describe to me what is Lincoln's place in American history in terms of the Civil War and what's the common belief about him?
Well, Lincoln, of course, is the single greatest towering figure over the Civil War. He was a remarkable man. He came from really nowhere, so to speak, and rose to become one of the most effective presidents in our history. There's no question about that. There's nothing I want to say that would diminish Lincoln. However, there has been an historical tendency over the 150 years or so in between to attribute all the Northern politics of the war to Lincoln. In other words, whatever the North did, Lincoln did it, which is basically hagiography. It's that's not, strictly speaking, history. Lincoln was a very assertive president for his time. In the 19th century, most presidents were, in fact, extremely deferential to Congress, passive presidents by comparison to those of the 20th century. Lincoln was a comparatively assertive one, like Andrew Jackson. That said, in the 19th century, virtually everyone, whether in politics or the general public, regarded Congress as the main engine of power in government, not the presidency. That's a 20th century phenomenon. I mean, we almost, without questioning it, assume that the presidency always is and has been, always has been, the main driving power force in government. And that just was not true in the 19th century. The founders didn't set it up that way. The founders, in fact, worried more about whether they could put enough power into the presidency to make it viable. They didn't worry about an imperial presidency. That's a modern idea. So, in short, I think we tend to attribute far more power and even leadership to Lincoln than the facts of the era warrant.
Right. And one other thing with that, I think to give some listeners more context about this idea of the presidency, which really doesn't exists in the 20th and 21st century just because of the powers of the office today. I had a guest whose favorite president was John Tyler, if you can believe that, for the very reasons that you said, and most people list him at the bottom of the list of presidents. And this gets into the core argument of what the presidency is, because John Tyler had a very different idea, for better or for worse, from today. So could you maybe say a few things about John Tyler and how he's radically different from, let's say, Lincoln, a stronger president, and his view of what the presidency should be?
Well, John Tyler, I must say, is an acquired taste. Yeah. Okay, John Tyler was a bit anomalous, okay? Yeah. He was elected as the vice presidential running mate with William Henry Harrison, Tippecanoe and Tyler too. Tippecanoe was, the nickname for William Henry Harrison. William Henry Harrison was the first Whig who succeeded in being elected president. He was a war hero of the time, and they had to scratch around a bit to find a running mate that would seem appropriate. John Tyler was a disaffected Democrat, a Southern Democrat, and it looked like a good match at the time, but Harrison died 3 months into his term as a result of pneumonia. Tyler suddenly and unexpectedly became president, the first time a vice president had become president in our history. And it turned out that Tyler, even though he was a disaffected Democrat, was still basically a Democrat, not a Whig. He therefore alienated Whigs, and he had very few friends among Democrats. But all that said, he was not, by our standards, a decisive president. But I have to say that was in part because people did not like him. People didn't like him. He had what we call negative charisma, Nixonian charisma, so to speak, for that time. But he was more in keeping with the type of man who served as president in the early 19th century and into the late 19th century as well, which is to say, deferential to Congress. He saw his role more as carrying out the legislation that had been passed by Congress than in introducing legislation. Now, Lincoln, by the way, thought pretty much the same way. Lincoln virtually said as much before he came into office. But the circumstances of the Civil War demanded something much more than that. I mean, Lincoln was, in fact, even though an assertive president, he was pretty deferential to Congress in ways that we would recognize. He never once refused a request from Congress. He never refused to answer a question put to him by Congress, unlike our most recent president who spent 4 years in a state of defiance towards Congress. And Lincoln edged into the decisive presidency that we remember him for by force of circumstances. Nobody, not Lincoln, not the Republicans in Congress, no one expected a four-year war that was going to cost 750,000 lives. It was on no one's agenda. And the Republicans, who had never held power before, There'd never been a Republican president, and there had never been Republican control of the three branches before. It was a new thing. Could they even govern? It wasn't obvious. Would Republicans even stay intact in the course of the war? The Democratic Party had split already between the Southern Democrats, who were basically secessionists, nearly all of them left Congress, and Northern Democrats, who were split again between pro-war and anti-war factions. With the Republicans split too, were all Republicans really ready to fight a war? Bear in mind, the federal treasury was in deficit at the time. That's a long story by itself. There was no money. There was no money. The coffers were bare with the prospect of having to raise how many thousands, tens of thousands, ultimately hundreds of thousands and millions of troops who had to be paid. Equipment had to be paid for. Cavalry horses had to be bought and fed, cannon had to be forged, and so on and so on. The prospect of fighting this war was really daunting. Plus, everybody knew it was over slavery, and a great many Republicans were perfectly happy, to tolerate slavery so long as it stayed in the South and didn't expand, didn't go west, didn't come north. And many, many, many young Northern men had no intention of fighting a war to free slaves. the war was not framed that way at the beginning. It was a war to reunify the nation. But it fairly quickly became clear that slavery was going to die as a result of the war. And it complicated the motives of people who fought it greatly. So Lincoln is maneuvering his way through these and many, many other complicated issues. But many of the initiatives, policies that drove the war politically came out of Congress rather than from the White House. Now, Lincoln was a man who had found a degree of decisiveness in him that the country didn't see before, and that indeed many Republicans in Congress hadn't seen before. He was pilloried. He was constantly challenged and attacked, not just by Democrats in Congress, and not just as a tyrant because he was decisive, but as an incompetent. Much of this was very unfair. It was very political. But Lincoln was a learn-on-the-job president. He didn't come into the presidency knowing how to be a president. He'd only had one rather lackluster term in Congress more than a decade earlier and had been a state legislator in the state of Illinois. He was not in the center of power by any means. He didn't know how to be a president. He was working it out as he went. Now, it speaks to Lincoln's character and depth that he pretty much did work it out. We have had other presidents faced with great challenges in their own times who really could not figure it out and didn't do very well. Lincoln, we have to say, did pretty well. But nonetheless, the driving initiatives, for one, raising the money to fight the war, and this is not a small thing. It's not as sexy as ending slavery. But the war could not have been won without raising huge amount of money from various sources. It came from Congress. The motivation, the step-by-step-by-step march toward emancipation, which wasn't just one thing. There was a lot of legislation that surrounded and led up to it. That came out of Congress. The push was not coming from the White House. Recruiting black troops to fight came out of Congress. And I want to mention three other really major pieces of legislation. Lincoln agreed with these that are not typically thought of as wartime legislation, but the Homestead Act, opening up the West to settlement, the Transcontinental Railroad, carrying the railway all the way to California, unifying the nation, the creation of land-grant colleges, all these came out of Congress. Lincoln didn't oppose them, but the energy came out of Congress. So what you have, at least, is a dynamic, is a very creative dynamic between an activist Congress, activist in the sense that we understand it today in the 20th century, a Congress that wanted to get things done, was very well led, had some brilliant people in it, had some mediocrities and losers too, but the leadership was really very, very impressive. A dialogue between Congress and the president.
Well, what you mentioned earlier, that a lot of what Lincoln does, it's not simply his own idea, but it's in response to legislation that comes from Congress. And that gets to the core of your book, that there are figures in Congress that are leading many of the things that happened in the Civil War and afterwards. And something you mention is that they reinvent the nation's financial system, they push for emancipation, they lay the foundation for a strong central government after the Civil War. And what you do in your book is you look at four specific people: Thaddeus Stevens, Pitt Fessenden, Ben Wade, and Clement Vallandigham. And they all have different positions on these issues, but let's go through them and look at these issues through the vessel of them. So tell me about Thaddeus Stevens and the role he plays during and after the Civil War.
Well, Thaddeus Stevens is probably, certainly among the most important, if not the most important, largely misunderstood and forgotten major political figures in American history. Thaddeus Stevens was born in Vermont, born dirt poor by dint of determination and a very strong-willed mother who guided him through his education. He rose to become a brilliant lawyer, moved to Pennsylvania, eventually moved into politics, and was an early abolitionist. And he was in the unusual category of not being a religious abolitionist. He wasn't a very religious man at all, but a political abolitionist who was also a pragmatist. That's to say, an idealist who got things done. He had been in Congress briefly at the end of the 1840s, was reelected in 1859, and he rapidly became the dominant figure in the U.S. House of Representatives. And at a time when there was no majority leader, the office didn't exist, but he was in effect the floor leader for much of the most important legislation during the war, a driving force, a passionate, articulate, caustic, take no prisoners driving force on behalf of legislation that would ultimately lead to the emancipation of the enslaved and to the liberalization of laws, to the civil rights laws that we cherish today. Unlike many anti-slavery idealists, as I said, I emphasize, he got things done. He knew how to craft legislation. He knew how to persuade other men to agree with him and to scare off some of those who didn't. He was a very tough character. After the Civil War, he was, again, a driving force in Reconstruction legislation, really the man who more than anyone else shaped the 14th Amendment. And he was also the leader in the effort to impeach Andrew Johnson, which failed, of course. Stevens died in 1868 at a time when it was still possible to imagine that Reconstruction was going to triumph. It didn't, as we know. Stevens, as chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, which because of his caustic temperament was sometimes known as the Mean Ways Committee, that's the committee that originates money bills. So Stevens was one of the pivotal people in ensuring that money could be found to pay for this immensely costly war effort. He was absolutely essential, so, to financing the war and to civil rights legislation throughout this period. Very influential man. William Pitt Fessenden, another New Englander from Maine, was a senator, very, very experienced legislator, very well respected, very serious man, a lawyer, as was Stevens, a protege of Daniel Webster. William Pitt Fessenden counted as a conservative Republican at the time. Thaddeus Stevens was one of the most prominent radical Republicans. That difference between radical and conservative really was divided by the issue of slavery. Radicals wanted immediate emancipation, complete emancipation, full civil rights, complete equality with white Americans. Conservatives were more hesitant, more cautious. They didn't necessarily oppose those things in principle, but they were often shy of supporting them legislatively. Fessenden, however, even though he came from an abolitionist home, did not count himself an abolitionist. However, he embraced all radical positions in the course of the war because pragmatically he considered it absolutely necessary to destroy slavery in order to win the war. And in that sense, he cooperated with the radicals, even though he differed temperamentally from them. Fessenden was the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, in other words, Stevens' counterpart in the Senate. So they worked in tandem on all the financial measures that I've kind of alluded to. And Fessenden also, because he was immensely respected and because in part he was recognized as a somewhat conservative political figure, was extremely influential in bringing other, let's call them moderates perhaps, around behind radical legislation. If Fessenden was for it, it's probably okay. Ben Wade, Benjamin Franklin Wade, was also a senator, a Republican, a radical Republican, very much in Stevens's mold. He was a big, swaggering, loud, extremely profane gentleman who was born, like Stevens, dirt poor in Massachusetts, and then as a young man walked from Springfield, Massachusetts, all the way to Ohio to make a life for himself, along the way doing odd jobs, including working as a laborer on the Erie Canal. And in Ohio, he managed to get himself trained as a lawyer and became acknowledged as one of the best, most effective lawyers in the state of Ohio. Ultimately a national figure, elected to the Senate, and absolutely two-fisted advocate of equal rights for Black Americans, hardcore abolitionist, even though he used language in talking about race that would make us cringe today. He was a paradox, as were many people in the 19th century. They did not hew to today's woke standards of expressing themselves. So he was a paradoxical figure, a bit of a bully, frankly, and at a time just before the war when Southerners very frequently threatened Northerners, especially abolitionists, with violence on the floor of Congress. Wade was well known for carrying a weapon with him and laying it across his desk when he was about to give a speech. And it worked. Nobody tangled with Ben Wade. Ben Wade is especially significant because he was also the chairman of the Joint Committee on the Conduct of the War, which sounds like a boring mouthful. It was a tremendously important and effective committee. It was a committee that was founded after the Union disaster at Bull Run. Northerners thought and hoped that the war would be won at that first battle, Manassas Bull Run, in July of 1861. Instead, it was a debacle for the Union, inexplicable. And Wade, Ben Wade, and other members demanded an investigation into it, and they began to demand a serious commitment to a long and hard war. That's a hard war means fight to the end, fight to win, no compromise with slavery, no compromise with the South, which ultimately became national policy long before Lincoln embraced it, by the way. So the Joint Committee had the responsibility for investigating any and all aspects of the waging of the war, ranging from corrupt contracts to the actual tactics and strategy employed by officers of the federal armies. The committee, had hundreds of officers, serving officers, from lieutenants and captains all the way up to generals, commanding generals, in Washington to be, you could say, interviewed, and in some cases they were interrogated about what went wrong, why it went wrong, whose fault was it, and where did the responsibility lie, and how were they going to be made accountable. This was a remarkable committee. As you might imagine, a lot of soldiers hated it, having a bunch of politicians looking over their shoulders. On the other hand, that committee pushed the administration, and I do mean Lincoln here, one, to embrace a hard war policy, a fight to win, and also to hire more effective generals rather than the numerous, not very effective ones who dominated at the beginning of the war. That's Ben Wade. These men were really at the core of congressional action during the war and of the Republican leadership in different ways, very different personalities, all of them very, very effective, decisive men. The fourth person I write about at some length is a bit of a ringer, frankly. He's not a Republican. He's an anti-war Democrat, Clement L. Vallandigham, who's an Ohio congressman, who was in many ways a very talented and impressive individual. That's to say, he had an excellent education, vastly well-read. He was very, very eloquent. His pictures don't do him justice, I think, but he was apparently pretty charismatic in person. On the other hand, he was as hardcore a reactionary with respect to the issue of race as existed in the U.S. Congress. As I said, he was an anti-war Democrat from Dayton, Ohio, as it happens. And it's hard to read some of his speeches and writings today because they are so thick with racism that makes one grow pale. Even those of us who are pale to begin with grow paler. And his family origins actually were Southern. So he tended to reflect Southern views. And Vallandigham represents, at least in the way I've introduced him in the book, the voice of all those Northerners who really didn't want the war. They didn't want to fight the war. They especially didn't want to fight a war to free Black people. They didn't want civil rights. They didn't like Lincoln. And bear in mind, the Lincoln was elected as a plurality president. He never had a majority. It was as if Ross Perot had been elected president in 1992, you know, if anybody remembers back that far. So much of the country, and not just in the South, essentially was hostile to Lincoln, or at least distrusted him, and certainly was hostile to the policies that we today admire as a kind of progressive moving forward of the country toward at least the principles of racial equality, even if it wasn't fulfilled in fact as much as we would have liked at the time. So Clement Vallandigham, therefore, even though he was just a congressman, was a national lightning rod for this. And his career in the war was a lot rockier because he was always in the minority. He was never in a position to pass any legislation, but rather to throw bricks from the sidewalk as the parade went by, so to speak. But he also mobilized or electrified those constituencies I just referred to that didn't want the war. And he gave them a kind of an official inspiration, if you like. He was gerrymandered out of his seat in the election of 1862. But in the Civil War era, a serving member who, for example, lost in 1862 would still be sitting until December of 1863. The term lame duck period really refers to that, except it was a year long in that era, quite different from today. So even though he was defeated in 62, he was actually sitting in principle until the end of 63. However, he was such a thorn in the side of the administration that the general commanding the region that took in southern Ohio actually had ordered his men to raid Vallandigham's house. They arrested him, took him out in his nightshirt, so to speak. I think they allowed him to get his pants on, but that was about it. Jailed him in Ohio, and they were going to try him for treason. Except this produced such an intense outcry, and not just from Democrats, but also from Republicans who saw it as a civil liberties issue, a free speech issue. Well, we may hate Vallandigham. His views are contemptible, but he has a right to say it, doesn't he? He has a right to speak, doesn't he? A lot of people were arrested during the Civil War by the Northern authorities for challenging the war effort. Ordinary citizens, editors of newspapers were jailed. Now, this is one could say, the dark side of the Union war effort. On the other side, and insofar as the dark side, you have to see Vallandigham and some others like him as some of the most important dissidents, certainly anti-war dissidents in American history. I don't think that can be overlooked. That said, there really was subversion underway in the North. Vallandigham encouraged it. He encouraged resistance to the draft, which was very unpopular in the North. Indirectly, if not directly, he encouraged desertion from the army. There was a massive desertion problem every time, after every string of lost battles, the Northern armies hemorrhaged men. So did the Southern armies, by the way. So Vallandigham was perceived increasingly, the name for this kind of person is a copperhead, like a snake, obviously, was perceived as the incarnation of those Northerners who were trying to subvert the war effort.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. Well, I wonder, as an aside, you described their personality and a lot of them sound really aggressive and unpleasant. And do you think in order to be effective as a radical Republican or a conservative or whatever stripe they were that were able to successfully work in Congress in a time of war, do you think that's a coincidence or there's a correlation there? Just as an aside, look at them psychologically.
Well, Scott, I think you find that correlation throughout American history pretty much. I think it's pretty much as true today as it might have been then. But to answer that a slightly different way, the mid-19th century was an era of extremely vivid, strong political personalities. Bear in mind, politics was the great gladiatorial arena of 19th century America. There was no television, there were no movies, there were no popular sports, none, zero, none of that existed. It was in politics that people, that American citizens who were fascinated by politics, much more motivated than America and engaged than Americans have largely been in our lifetimes. Everybody followed politics. People turned out in prodigious numbers, even in rural areas, for political debates like the Lincoln-Douglas debates and so on, or for stump speeches. These were popular events, and there was no greater magnet for tourists in America in the 19th century than the Gallery of Congress. And those seats up there were packed. They were packed with people standing in the hall saying, "What did he say? What did he say? Hit him again. Hit him again." You know, people were very engaged. It was also, not coincidentally, the great age of political oratory. And oratory at that time was a kind of spoken art. It wasn't just talk. It was a spoken art. You read some of the many of the speeches delivered during the Civil War and then the generation before it. And they read like literature. They read like literature. These men were extraordinary in their ability often to speak for 1, 2, 3, 4 hours at a clip with no notes. No notes. And you read it today and it's interesting. It's still interesting. I mean, it's a challenge because where you go to read these, what's called the Congressional Globe, that's the predecessor of the Congressional Record. And it's all online. You can get anything on the Congressional Globe from the founding all the way up to 1873 with a couple of clicks on your computer in about 8-point type. So if you can actually read the type, you'll enjoy reading it. So it was a culture that favored strong, vigorous, assertive, even aggressive personalities. But another way of speaking to that, Scott, is that it's very hard to get anything done in politics. It was hard then. It's hard now. Very difficult. It's not a place for, Congress isn't a place for wimps. Crafting legislation is difficult, time-consuming. Every piece of legislation is a web of compromises, small compromises, big compromises, people yielding on points of not just pride, but moral points. It's very difficult work, and it's a type of work that doesn't suffer fools very well. And Congress, of course, had in those days plenty of mediocrities and second-rate personalities and alcoholics and generally ineffectual people. Lots of people didn't get reelected.
Yeah, one of them became president after Lincoln. So there you go.
well, okay. I'll take you on that. Okay, we have Andrew Johnson. I don't think Andrew Johnson was a mediocrity at all. I just think his politics were repugnant to us. Mm-hmm. There was a reason why he was selected as vice president, which I think was Lincoln's worst single decision as president. Worst, bar none. And I do lay this at Lincoln's doorstep, even though he didn't exactly point at Johnson and say, I want that man. He didn't have to have Johnson. Lincoln's first vice president was a man named Hannibal Hamlin, a name forgotten by most Americans. He had been an eminent senator from Maine, along with Fessenden, very good senator. And he was a visceral abolitionist. He was excellent on civil rights and on supporting emancipation and full rights for Black. And he and Lincoln never quite got along particularly well. Lincoln almost never saw him. It was a shame. It was Hamlin was wasted in the vice presidency. Why was he picked? Because the Republican Party in 1860 wanted a New England abolitionist, because that's where Lincoln was weak. He was a Westerner and not an abolitionist, contrary to what many people might assume. Lincoln was hostile to slavery, but he wasn't an abolitionist. He became one during the war. Okay. So in 1864, Lincoln expects to lose. This is on paper. Lincoln had already written what would have been a public letter to his successor, who would have been the former Union general, George McClellan, who had led the Union army to defeat after defeat early in the war, and was the Democratic nominee in 1864. The war was going very poorly for the North. There had been many defeats, squandered victories, prodigious loss of life, loss of national treasure. People were disillusioned. Lincoln was under constant attack from Democrats and Republicans by this point, 63, 64. And in the spring, even into the summer of 64, it looked to a lot of people as if Lincoln was going to be defeated. What would have happened then? George McClellan was what was called a war Democrat, but he promised a ceasefire. Basically, that would have led to some sort of accommodation with the South. McClellan claimed he'd continue fighting, but nobody believed that there was a ceasefire. If there was a ceasefire, soldiers would ever pick their guns up again. That's what was in store. With some desperation, the Republican Party dumped Hannibal Hamlin, abolitionist from Maine, and was searching for a Democrat to put on the city on the ticket in order to win some support from wavering, quavering, maybe anti-war, semi-anti-war Democrats. And particularly, they opted for a Democrat from, now he's from Tennessee, Andrew Johnson's from Tennessee, but most of Tennessee had been reclaimed by the Union armies at this point. So Tennessee is, you can count as kind of a border state. It's no longer a Confederate state by 1864. So here's Johnson, who is supposed to win votes for the ticket. It's not even called the Republican Party in 1864. It's called the Union Party. And so this was a calculated political decision. Why Andrew Johnson? One, he was the only senator from the Confederate states who stayed with the Union. Not only did he stay with the Union, he was a ferocious Unionist and was the wartime governor of Tennessee, at which he did an excellent job. An excellent job. He was a populist in a good sense, which is to say he was interested in the interests of the working man, the small farmer. There were far more in the America of the 1860s than there are today. So there were a lot of reasons for Johnson to be put on the ticket, and Northern radicals wanted him. They liked him because he had been such a hard-fisted war governor in Tennessee. They were quickly disabused. And this is what happened, of course, after Lincoln's assassination, was a kind of tragic replay of what happened after William Henry Harrison's death in 1841, to be succeeded by John Tyler, a closet Democrat who wasn't a Whig. We talked about him earlier. And Whig policy just went nowhere after Tyler became president. And after Andrew Johnson became president, Republican policy stopped in its tracks, except for these extremely forceful men like Stevens, Wade, Fessenden, and others in Congress who kept pushing, but it was pushing a Sisyphean rock uphill after the war while Johnson was president, because Johnson turned around and began re-enfranchising ex-Confederates almost instantly and favoring and fostering the return of basically treasonous Southerners to power in the South. Because his only future, if he was to be reelected in 68, was a lot of support from Southern Democrats.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. So to look at the different characters in your book, you talk about their legacy, that they lay a foundation for a strong central government that came into being in the 20th century. With their legacy in mind, why do you think it's important to understand that Lincoln alone didn't win the Civil War, but the House and the Senate also played a critical role?
Well, look, most of all, I think we today have an extremely unbalanced grasp of how the federal government's supposed to function. As I said earlier in our conversation, you know, nearly all Americans assume that the presidency is the center of power and Congress really is there to kind of just do what the president wants. Rediscovering the kind of balance the founders pretty wisely intended by organizing the national government the way it is. It's very hard to craft good legislation. It takes a long time. It's not instantaneous. We shouldn't seek immediate gratification in politics. No matter how strong our views and our principles might be, immediate gratification in politics lies in the direction of authoritarianism. The big man who can do it all, who claims he can do it all, who can get things done, which was a term applied to every dictator of the 20th century. One, we see Congress in a way at its best in a time of tremendous crisis like no other that the country ever faced. And Congress collaboratively with the president, led the country through it, which tells you a number of things. One, the country can face any kind of crisis. Democracy is perfectly well prepared to deal with any degree of crisis. Another truth is democracy is messy. It's not efficient. It's not simple. Nobody gets all that he wants, but it works. It works. And I'm extremely worried about the declining public confidence in democracy and our national political institutions over the last generation or so, not just the last 4 years. I mean, there have been reliable polls which have showed that fewer than 10% of the public have confidence in Congress. Fewer than 10%. Fewer than 10%. Within my lifetime, that figure was 60 to 70%. And as many as a third of young Americans, that's teenagers, late teens, early 20s, don't think that democracy is the most important form of government. These are shocking figures. We can't afford this. So, look at the Congress of the Civil War. You see Congress in action, solving problems that they didn't even know existed, but doing it very well with the best people rising to the top, I think, many of the best people anyway, and crafting legislation. I spend a lot of the time in my book looking at how some of the important legislation was drawn, how it was made. It's a creative process. I mean, I think it would benefit us if we looked at politics again as a creative process and not some, kind of a boring slog with a lot of details we don't understand. It's creative. It's a collaborative, creative process. And I'm a narrative historian. As you know, you read the book. I'm a narrative historian. I write history as story. And I'm interested in how people accomplish things. I'm not a political scientist. The abstractions of politics don't interest me all that much. And we see people more or less like ourselves, or more or less like the members of today's Congress, more or less, pretty much the same balance of brilliance and mediocrity as usual. But we see them during the Civil War how did it come to be that African-American slaves were emancipated? It wasn't just the Emancipation Proclamation, which, as I think, and many people know by now, didn't actually emancipate many slaves in the South. I mean, it set a principle. What it did was establish a principle of emancipation, okay? But Lincoln was in no position to actually emancipate people in the Confederacy, okay? But many pieces of legislation and much creative thinking went into bringing that about. Slaves were emancipated in the District of Columbia in 1862. A whole different approach was taken, but they were all emancipated. It had already happened in 1862. A general, Benjamin Butler, in 1861, had been faced with the dilemma of what to do with fugitive slaves who were flooding into his base in the state of Virginia. And he was a lawyer. He was a brilliant lawyer, a clubhouse politician. Brilliant lawyer, though. Terrible general. But he hit on the idea, legally, of declaring fugitive slaves to be contraband of war. Now, this wasn't a declaration of emancipation or abolition, but it gave the Union a legal basis for accepting fugitives and therefore a safe harbor for slaves who wanted to defect to the Union. And during the course of the war, hundreds of thousands of them, wherever the Union armies marched, slaves defected en masse to the Union, many of them later becoming Union soldiers. The Emancipation Proclamation wouldn't have been possible had not Benjamin Butler made that decision, which was backed up by Congress, I should say. It had to go to Congress eventually, and it became congressional policy, treating fugitive slaves as contraband. So there's a whole process. I want to reiterate, I don't want to take anything away from Lincoln. He was a magnificent man. There's probably never been a deeper individual in the presidency. And he rose to the occasion. He was a learn on the job president, but he learned. He didn't fail to learn. He really did learn. And he was really a great president by the later years of the war. But the Emancipation Proclamation was just his contribution to a process that was already being carried out. So I think, I hope with this book and a couple of others I've written as well that deal with 19th, even late 18th century American politics, I can lead some people to think, I think more hopefully, about the way we do politics, at least the way we do government. It's not quite the same as politics, the way we do government and the way these institutions work, and to reappreciate, extraordinarily, if potentially effective institutions these are. Yeah, it's slow. It's very frustrating. And a lot of things we might want to see legislated don't happen. It doesn't happen because we're a diverse and complicated country, but we've always been that. James Madison knew it was, even in his own time, the late 18th century, a diverse and complicated country. It was just a different diversity. The complications were different. But that's why the government was organized the way it was. Now, not to digress into the, I wrote a book of the history of the first Congress as well, in which I addressed these issues at that time. So, you know, I think it's imperative that we, you know, rediscover how Congress works and that does work, that can work.
Well, there's a lot to dig into here. And there's also a lot of stories and character studies of people who many of the listeners wouldn't be familiar with, as you outlined here. And for listeners who want to get more into these stories, the name of the book is Congress at War: How Republican Reformers Fought the Civil War, Defied Lincoln, Ended Slavery, and Remade America. Fergus, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Scott. It's been a great pleasure. I appreciate it.
All right. That is all for today's episode. As a first order of business, I need to thank the Knowlton's Rangers, and I'll explain what that is in a second. And they are Kristen Lee, Willie from New Jersey, Sumo 41, Sergeant Hooch, Wire Meets Wood Guitars at WMWGuitars.com, Bill Ivey, Tom from Ohio, Salvador Sanchez, Dane Carlson from Linwood, Washington, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael Piccinetti, Michael from New York, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial Las Vegas, Josh Reddick, Jake Harrington, Josh from BFW Post 2285, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Frieza. Now, if you'd like to support History Unplugged and help it grow, there are three easy ways to do so. First, subscribe to the show and leave a review on the podcast player of your choice. This helps other people discover the show. Second, join our Facebook group, and here you can discuss recent episodes with fellow listeners, mention what you'd like to see on the show in the future, and get way more out of the show, and just look for History Unplugged on Facebook. Third, become a member of the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were an elite reconnaissance and espionage detachment of the Continental Army established by George Washington, but it's also the membership group of History Unplugged, and here you can really dive in way deeper with the show. You can check it out by going to Patreon, patreon.com/unplugged. If you join at the Scout level, you get early access to new podcast episodes, and you get completely ad-free versions of the entire back catalog of more than 500 episodes. Plus, everything is neatly categorized, so if you want to listen to something about the Middle Ages and skip all the Civil War stuff or vice versa, you can easily find an old episode from 3 years ago that, if you're just looking on Apple Podcasts, would be buried in the feed. If you join at the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the same stuff, but access to a growing catalog of now more than 60 premium episodes that come out bi-weekly, including a multi-part series on the life of Audie Murphy, the most decorated combat soldier in World War II, a series on French Foreign Legion fighters in World War I, one on Teddy Roosevelt's years in the Dakota Badlands, and a series on Nazi attempts to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Lastly, if you join the Spymaster level, you get all the same stuff as level 1 and 2, but you also get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You can choose a historical topic on absolutely anything, and I'll base an hour-long episode on it. Plus, you get a 3-pack of hardcover books. So again, check it all out by going to patreon.com/unplugged. Well, that's all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next time.